We began looking at the Olivet Discourse last Sunday night that Jesus gave to the disciples up on the Mount of Olives, and they had come to him with three questions. So look with me in Matthew chapter 24. Look at verse 3. It says, as he, Jesus, sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, tell us, when will these things be? What will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? These things was the destruction of Jerusalem. And they were wondering, when will that take place? That's the first question. And then, what will be the sign of your coming? And what will be the sign of the end of the age? And we talked about the fact that Jesus answers those questions in reverse order. We talked about the fact that that end of the age that they ask about is a time period. It's not a particular point in time, but it's a period of time that marked what's going to be, what are the events that will mark the end period of the age of God's dealings with the people of Israel. And we read there his answer beginning in verse 4. Jesus answered and said to them, take heed that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and will deceive many. You will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you're not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. Now, that word end that's used there is an end point in time. It's not the end period, but an end point. And that he says, the end is not yet. All of these things you'll see. Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. He says, all these are the beginning of sorrows. The things that we see listed here in Matthew chapter 24, verses 4 through 8, which he says are the beginning of sorrows, all of these things, I think, are the same things we see pictured in the first four seals that are opened in Revelation chapter 6. Turn there with me for just a second. And let's just read through these very quickly and just remind ourselves of what he said. When the Lamb opens the seven-sealed scroll that we saw there in Revelation chapter 5, we see each one of the seals marks the beginning of a judgment. And so verse 1, now I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seals and heard one of the four living creatures saying with a loud voice, with a voice like thunder, come and see. And John says, and I looked and behold a white horse, and he who sat on it had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he went out conquering and to conquer. That white horse, I think, is a picture of the coming of the false Christ or the Antichrist, the beast that rises up out of the sea. And so this is not Christ himself, because the Lamb is the one who opens the seal and sends him forth. The second seal is open, verses 3 and 4, and we see another rider, this time on a fiery red horse. And it says in verse 4, it was granted to the one who sat on the red horse to take peace from the earth, and that people should kill one another, and it was given to him a great sword. So here we see the wars and rumors of wars that take place. That's described back in Matthew as well. The third seal is a black horse holding a pair of scales. Verse 6, I heard a voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, a quart of wheat for a denarius and three quarters of barley for a denarius, and do not harm the oil and the wine. And that's a picture of famine. There will be coming upon the earth famine as well. And then finally, the fourth seal is in verse 7. The fourth living creature sees, verse 8, a pale horse. And the name of him who sat on this horse was Death, and Hades followed with him. And power was given to them over a fourth of the earth to kill with several different things, with the sword, with hunger, with death, and by the beasts of the earth. Those are the same things we see in Ezekiel chapter 14, the four sore judgments that God will bring upon the people of Israel and upon the earth. But all of these things, he says, are the beginning of sorrows. Do you remember what we said that word sorrows means back in Matthew 24? Birth pains, yes. The pains of a woman who's in labor, just about to bring forth a child. That's what we see pictured. Now, the reason he says this is the beginning of sorrows is because this is the beginning of that time period that will bring about the birth of the nation of Israel. That nation will be born in a day. But before they are born, they're going to have to go through the birth pangs of the tribulation period. And so that's what we looked at last time, is what is the beginning of sorrows. And I think it corresponds to those first four seals that we see there in Revelation chapter 6. Now, let's go back to Matthew 24 and continue looking at this. Go down with me to verse 9. Right after he says these are the beginning of sorrows, and he says, then, after the beginning of sorrows, it says, they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. The first thing we see that happens after the birth pangs is a time of tribulation, a time in which people are delivered up to be killed. This is martyrdom. This is the hatred of the saints, primarily the saints of Israel. Now, what will mark this? The beginning of sorrows, those first four seals, and then it follows up with tribulation and death. Look with me in the book of Revelation chapter 12. Revelation chapter 12. And go down with me to verse 13. Verses 7 through 12 describe a war that takes place in heaven. And Michael and his angels fight against the devil and his angels. And the devil and his angels are cast out of heaven to the earth. Now, this is what happens after that. Verse 13. Now, when the dragon, that is the devil, when the dragon saw that he had been cast to the earth, what does he do? He persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. So, she's already given birth to the male child, that's Christ. Now comes the sorrows and the pains, the persecution. But the woman was given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness to her place where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time, which is 3.5 times, or the last 3.5 years of the tribulation period. She is nourished from the presence of the serpent. And so the serpent spewed water out of his mouth like a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away by the flood. But the earth helped the woman. The earth opened its mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. And the dragon was enraged and with the woman, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. In Revelation chapter 13, which follows right after this, we see the rise of the beast out of the sea. That is the Antichrist, I believe. When he rises up, he's going to make war with the saints. Look at verse 7. It was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them, and authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. And look at verse 15. The false prophet, when he rises, was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. So we've got people dying because of the testimony of Jesus Christ, and we've got tribulation coming upon them, that last portion. So when you go back to Matthew 24 and you look there at verse 9, I think what we're seeing is kind of events that will take place that marks the middle of that 7-year period. The last 3.5 years of that, there will be tribulation, there will be martyrs, there will be people that are hated by all nations for the sake and for the name of the Lord Jesus Christ. Look at verse 10. Go back to Matthew 24. Look at verse 10. He says, "And then many will be offended. They will betray one another, and they will hate one another." You're going to find that's going to be taking place in Israel. We know that during that tribulation period, God is, in a sense, going to refine the people of Israel. He's going to put them through these fires of judgment, and two-thirds of them are going to be killed, or many of them are going to turn away from the Lord. That's who he's talking about here in verse 10. Many will be offended because of Christ. He will become a stumbling block to them. They will find the testimony of Jesus Christ to be offensive to them, and so they will betray one another. They will hate one another. You'll see a lot of infighting, even among the people of Israel during that time. And we see that. That's why in Revelation 13:10 and Revelation 14:12, he talks about here's the patience and faith of the saints as they go through this terrible time. Even when Jesus was teaching while he was here on this earth, he said, "Blessed are those who are not offended because of me." That was a message for the people then. That's a message that also will be valid for the people who live during the tribulation period, that they not be offended because of Christ. Look at verse 11. He says, "Then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many." Not only there will be many false prophets, there will be one in particular who is called the false prophet. And he will rise up, and yes, he will deceive many. Look again at Revelation 13. Revelation 13, and look down at verse 11. It talks about his rise. There's the first beast that rises up out of the sea in verse 1 of this chapter. There's a second beast. John says, "Then I saw another beast coming up, this one out of the earth." He says, "And he had two horns like a lamb, and he spoke like a dragon." And it's interesting, two horns like a lamb, but he spoke like a dragon. Two very different sides there. "He exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence, and he causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. He performs great signs. This false prophet is a miracle worker, you might say. He performs great signs so that he even makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. What does that remind you of? Elijah, the days of Elijah, is proof of who is the one true God. He sees that proof and he's able to make fire come down. Verse 14, what does he do? He deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who was wounded by the sword and lived. So he is a deceiver. He is a false prophet. He's not a prophet of God. He is a false prophet. Look in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Paul, the Apostle Paul, describes him in this chapter as what's going to happen when the day of the Lord comes. Start reading with me in verse 8. He's described in this chapter as the lawless one. He says, 2 Thessalonians 2:8, "Then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will consume with the breath of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming." Now, it's not his coming for his church. That's his coming back to this earth to judge and make war. The coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan, with all power, signs, and lying wonders. Now, look at that word lying. The Greek word that's used there is the word pseudo. The Greek word pseudo, it means false. These are false wonders. "And with all unrighteous deception among those who perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth that they might be saved." He says, "For this reason God will send them strong delusion, that they should believe the lie," not a lie, but the lie of Satan, "that they all may be condemned who did not believe the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness." Because they rejected the truth, the false prophet's going to come and he's going to play on that fact. And once he's turned them away from the truth, he can easily turn them aside to fables. He will be a deceiver, and a deceiver even with the wonders that he's able to do. So many false prophets will arise and deceive many. And then going back to Matthew 24, verse 12 says, "And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold." The love of many will grow cold. So lawlessness is going to abound. What do we see that the false prophet was called there in 2 Thessalonians? What was his title? The lawless one. The lawless one. So he's going to bring that in. He'll have his own laws, but as far as the laws of God, it'll be a lawless society. And many people's love will grow cold, particularly their love of the truth and their love of Jesus Christ. It will grow cold as they move away and are offended because of him. Now look at verse 13, right here in Matthew 24. Look at verse 13. He says, "But he who endures to the end shall be saved." Now that word "end" here, again, is that end point in time. Not to the end period, but to the end of that end period. In order to be saved during that tribulation period, this is what you have to do. You have to endure. You have to endure through all this persecution. You have to endure through this tribulation and not be offended at the name and the testimony of Jesus Christ. In Revelation chapters 2 and 3, we saw the expression, "to him who overcomes." Same idea, I think. To him who overcomes and wins the victory over Satan and over the Antichrist. So this is without being offended because of Christ, without worshiping the beast or his image, without taking the mark of the beast. You can't do any of those things during that period, or you're going to be lost. That's not the message for today. That's not the message for how people are saved today. There are so many people who try to just mix up everything Jesus taught with the things that the Apostle Paul taught, and we get in all sorts of trouble in doing that because they say different things, and they're about different periods. And so, endurance to the end. Look at verse 14. "And this gospel of what? Of the kingdom." This gospel, or this good news of the kingdom, will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations. And after that, and then, the end will come. So in other words, that whole period of time, that gospel message of the kingdom, the good news of the kingdom, the coming king and his kingdom, is going to be preached everywhere, to all the world. Every nation is going to hear about it. And then, it says, the end will come. Those are the events that we see described in general. This is kind of very in general terms. That really carries us pretty much all the way to the end of the tribulation period. That end will come, is marked by the second coming of Jesus Christ back to this earth to establish his kingdom, to rule and reign upon the earth. Now, Let's look at something. Let's continue here, right here where we're studying, and let's look at some more specific details. What he does now is he gave some general overview. Here's the signs of the end of the age, but let me give you some particular signs of things to look for. And so here's the one key sign that he gives them, beginning in verse 15. He says, "Therefore, considering everything I just told you about the end of the age, therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place," he says, "whoever reads, let him understand." It's like, "He who has ears to hear, let him hear. Whoever reads, let him understand." He says, when you see that abomination of desolation standing in the holy place, that's in the Holy of Holies in the temple, he says, "then let those who are in Judea do what? Flee. Flee to the mountains." He says, "let him who is on the housetop not go down to take anything out of his house." You know, when you have a fire in your house, they say you're not supposed to run back in and grab things and try to take them out because you could be killed. Same kind of principle here. He says, you're on the housetop. You hear about the abomination of desolation. He says, you leave immediately. You don't stop to take anything. You don't go downstairs and get anything out of your house. You just flee right then. He says, let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes. Don't worry about that. He says, woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days, because it'll make travel difficult. It'll make it hard for you to travel. He says, and pray that your flight may not be in winter, because the difficulty of travel in winter. Or, what's the other thing? Pray that it's not on the Sabbath, because the Jews, under the law, were restricted on how far they could travel on a Sabbath day. So he says, pray that it doesn't happen on a Sabbath day either. In other words, you get out of Jerusalem, you get out of Judea very quickly. Why? Verse 21. For then, when you see this abomination of desolation standing in the holy place, then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time. No, nor ever shall be. In other words, you will not find in history or in the future anything worse than what's going to take place when you see this taking place in Jerusalem. He says, and unless those days were shortened, no flesh, nobody would be saved. He says, but for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. And then if anyone says to you, look, here's the... Oh, let's stop right there. Let's stop before we go. Let's just talk about this. This is a sign. He says, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet. Daniel mentions it several different times. One of the places that's mentioned is in Daniel chapter 9. Turn there with me just briefly. We'll just look at it. What does it mean? What does the word abomination mean? Something that's hated, something that's detestable. So what does desolation mean? Emptiness. So something that is hated, something that is detestable in the eyes of God, that will cause desolation or emptiness. Now, where is this abomination of desolation seen to be standing? In the holy place. In other words, the Holy of Holies. And why is it called the Holy of Holies? It's God's dwelling place on the earth among His people. That's where the Ark of the Covenant was, with the mercy seat covering it, with the cherubim whose wings went out across and met. And in between the cherubim and above the mercy seat is where God would actually dwell in the midst of His people. So that's His dwelling place. So it's holy. It is the holiest of places on earth. But now, what He says, you're going to see something that's an abomination in the eyes of God. And what it will cause is it will cause emptiness, desolation in God's temple, because God cannot dwell there with that there. Now, what are we talking about? Look at Daniel chapter 9. Look at verse 27. This is talking about the 77s that are determined by God upon Jerusalem and upon the people of Israel. The last seven-year period is described as a time when the prince who is to come, this is the Antichrist, I believe, the beast out of the sea, verse 27, he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week, or for 1 7-year period. So he's going to initiate a covenant between himself and primarily the people of Israel. What he's going to allow them to do is he's going to allow them to sacrifice and bring offerings and worship in their temple for a while. But it says there, in the middle of the week, after 3.5 years, it says, he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering. In other words, they're no longer going to be allowed to worship in their temple as they did before. And it says, and on the wing of abominations shall be one who makes desolate. Now, see, you've got both words in there. The wing of abominations, You've got someone who makes things desolate, even until the consummation which is determined is poured out on the desolate or on the desolator. Look at the Second Thessalonians again. What is he going to do? What is going to be set up in the temple that will cause this to take place? Cause God to look at it as an abomination and cause the holy place to be desolate. Second Thessalonians chapter 2. Look at verse 3. Start with me in verse 3. He says, "Let no one deceive you by any means, for that day," and I think here he has reference to the day of the Lord, the day of the Lord's judgment, "that day will not come unless the falling away comes first, and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition." Now, those are two more titles that are used for the Antichrist. He is called the man of sin, because that's what he's characterized by. He is called the son of perdition, because that's what his end is going to be, as his destruction. Notice what it says about him. He opposes, this is one who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God. Not just the one true God, but over any gods that anybody worships, any nation worships. He exalts himself above all that is called God, or that is worshipped, so that he sits as God, where? In the temple of God. Showing himself, or declaring himself, that he is God. Now, do you think that that would be an abomination in God's sight to have the Antichrist himself sitting in the temple of God in the place where God dwells? Yes, absolutely. Will not take place, though, until the middle of that 70th seven, the middle of that last seven-year period. This is when it happens. And that marks the change in everything. You know, when the Antichrist comes in, he's going to be preaching peace and safety for Israel. And then it says, and then sudden destruction will come upon them as labor pains come upon a woman who is pregnant. He says, that's how it'll be. They'll just be suddenly. And that's why in Matthew 24, Jesus warns and says that when you see this happen, then this marks the beginning of tribulation. It's going to come upon you quickly and rapidly, this time of terrible tribulation like the world has never seen. When you see it, he tells them to flee because the tribulation is coming. It'll be what Jeremiah describes as the time of Jacob's trouble. It'll be that when the time when the dragon is cast to the earth, that'll be in the middle of that period, and he'll persecute the woman, Israel, for that last 3.5 period, that time and times and half a time. And he says, if the days were not shortened, nobody would be saved. Nobody would be saved, but they will be. Now, go with me to Revelation chapter 6. We saw in Matthew 24, verses 9 and 10, we talked about the fact that people would be killed. There would be martyrs. There would be tribulation and persecution and martyrs. When Jesus opens the fifth seal, when the Lamb opens the fifth seal, look at verse 9 of Revelation 6. When he opened the fifth seal, he says, "I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held." Now, primarily, I think that those who were slain during that tribulation period. There will be a lot of people killed. That's exactly what Jesus warned about. There will be people who will die because of their testimony for the Lord. And these souls said, cried with a loud voice, saying, "How long, O Lord, holy and true, until you judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth?" And a white robe was given to each one of them, and it was said to them that they should rest a little while longer until both the number of their fellow servants and their brethren who would be killed as they were was completed. In other words, it's not going to be until the end of that tribulation period, the end of that for the last 3.5 years. You're going to have to wait until then, because there's more and more people who will go through just what you did. They'll be slain because of the word of God and for their testimony. So the fifth seal is those martyrs, the martyrs that we see, and that I think happens after the abomination of desolation is set up. So the first four seals, I think, correspond to the beginning of sorrows, which takes place, I believe, in the first half of that tribulation period, the first half of that Daniel 77. When we get to the fifth seal, we've jumped to the middle of that period, and when people are truly being killed for their testimony for the Lord Jesus. Now, go back with me to Matthew 24 one more time, and let's look at, and basically that's Jesus' answer to the first part of the disciples' question on the Mount of Olives. What will be the sign of the end of the age? What do we look for to mark the end of the age? And he gave them all those things to look for. False Christs, wars, famines, pestilence, death. All those things are just the beginning of sorrows. Then he, and more specifically, the abomination of desolation, that in particular, in the martyrs. Then the second question that they asked was, what shall be the sign of your coming? What do we look for to mark your coming back to this earth? And this is what he answers now. Look at verse Matthew 24, verse 23. He says, then if anyone says to you, look, here's the Christ, or there, do not believe it. If somebody tells you, look, the Christ is right here. He's already come. He's right here. Or he's there. Don't believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will rise and show great signs and wonders. Now, this is plural. There are many false Christs, many false prophets. There is one false Christ in particular, the Antichrist, and one false prophet who will stand out. But there'll be many who will rise up, and they'll claim to be Christ. They'll claim to be a prophet of God. He says they'll show great signs and wonders. They'll be able to work what appears to be miracles, although they may be lying or false wonders. And he says their purpose is to deceive, if possible, even the elect, even those who are saved. He says, see, look, I have told you this beforehand. I've already warned you that this is coming. Therefore, if they say to you, look, he's in the desert, he says, do not go out. Or say, look, he's in the inner rooms, do not believe it. Now, you see, all these false Christs and these false prophets will arise, in a sense, with secret appearances. He's out in the desert. He's appeared out into the desert. That's where he is. Or he's appeared here in this inner room. This is where he is. He's not going to come in secret. When the Lord Jesus Christ comes back to this earth and comes to judge and to fight the battle of Armageddon and to establish his kingdom, it's not going to be a secret appearance at all. It's going to be a very visible appearance. Look at verse 27. Here's how he's going to come. Here's the sign of his coming. For as the lightning comes from the east and flashes to the west, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. This is like when we have sometimes pretty good lightning storms here in Texas, and you can see the light just flashing all across the sky, you know, sometimes repeated lightning. But it's something that you can see. Everybody can see it. It flashes from one side of the heavens to the other. He says, that's the way the coming of the Son of Man will be. He says, for wherever the carcass is, there the eagles will be gathered together. When he comes, there won't be any question or any doubt. Every eye will be able to see him and see his coming when he returns to this earth. Not so with the rapture, when the Lord Jesus Christ appears to catch his church up into glory before this 70th seven ever begins. That will be, not really a secret coming, although his coming certainly was, the truth of it was a mystery. But it'll take place how? How does Paul describe it in 1 Corinthians 15? Yeah, it'll be in a moment. Take place in a moment, in a twinkling of an eye. You can't even see anything. You don't have time to see anything in that sort of time. But this coming is going to be different. You remember when Jesus ascended into heaven and the 11 apostles were there? And how did he go up? Yeah, he sort of rose up there. They watched him go up, and they watched a cloud receive him until he was out of sight. And what did the angels say? This same Jesus will so come in like manner as you saw him go. So in the same way you were able to watch him go up, when he comes back, it's going to be that same way. It's not going to be a secret appearing. It's going to be a very visible appearing with signs. Look at verse 29. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, it says, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. You've got signs in the heavens that affect the sun, and it'll be darkened. The moon will not give its light. The stars are going to fall from heaven. Even the powers of the heavens itself will be shaken. And then, he says in verse 30, the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven. And all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. He will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet. You'll be able to hear it as well. He says, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. So when Jesus Christ comes back, there will be magnificent and glorious signs in the heaven above that everybody will be able to see. When will it take place? What does he say in verse 29? Immediately after the tribulation of those days, and at the end of that time period that marks the end of the age, or the end period of the age, that's when it will take place. So, look with me at Revelation chapter 6 again. How does this fit in? Look at the sixth seal. Verse 12. John says, I looked when he, that's the Lamb, opened the sixth seal, and behold, there was a great earthquake. And the sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became like blood, and the stars of heaven fell to the earth as a fig tree drops its late figs when it's shaken by a mighty wind. That sounds similar? That's exactly the types of things we just saw in Matthew chapter 24. Here are the signs of the coming of the Son of Man when He returns to this earth to establish His kingdom. The sun, the moon, the stars are all affected. There's darkness, there's the stars falling to the earth and so forth. As when a fig tree is shaken by a mighty wind, and there's a great earthquake that happens as well. So all of these signs on earth, in particular in the heavens. Now, keep going. Look at verse 14. Then the sky receded as a scroll when it is rolled up, and every mountain and island was moved out of its place. And the kings of the earth, the great men, the rich men, the commanders, the mighty men, every slave and every free man, what did they do? They hid themselves in the caves and in the rocks of the mountains, and they said to the mountains and the rocks, fall on us. Fall on us and hide us from the face of Him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb, for the great day of His wrath has come, and who is able to stand? Now, when you get to that sixth seal, where does it take us? All the way to what point in time, seemingly? It seems to take us right up to the second coming. You've got the signs of His coming right there in verse 12 and 13. You've got the sky receding like a scroll, and in a sense, opening up. And everybody sees that and knows that it's taking place. And everybody of every class and every social class and financial class and so forth, everyone, including the kings of the earth and the great men, they're hiding themselves. They're hiding themselves in caves and in mountains and saying, fall on us and hide us from who? Number one, from the face of Him who sits on the throne that we saw in Revelation chapter 4. Very God Himself who sits on the throne. And from the wrath of the Lamb, who we see is the focal point of Revelation chapter 5. Because what we see in verse 17, the great day of God's wrath has come. It's not saying God's wrath has come. God's wrath has already come. And that's what we're going to see as we unfold the rest of these judgments. God's wrath has already come. This is the great day of His wrath. This is the great day of His wrath when it's going to be poured out on the earth and He's going to bring redemption for His people. And what does He say? And who is able to stand? Look with me in the book of Isaiah chapter 2 for just a second. Isaiah prophesied about the day of the Lord. And I want you to look at a similar thing we see here. Isaiah chapter 2, and let's start in verse... talking about the first part of this chapter talks about the establishment of the Lord's house. And then I believe His kingdom is being described there. Then goes down to verse 10. Look at verse 10. Isaiah 2:10. It says, enter into the rock and hide in the dust. Again, look at what we saw in Revelation chapter 6. Hiding from the face of the One who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. Enter into the rock and hide in the dust from the terror of the Lord and the glory of His majesty. The lofty looks of man shall be humbled. The haughtiness of men shall be bowed down, and the Lord alone shall be exalted in that day. You know, when you look at what's going to happen during the tribulation period, especially the last 3.5 years, Satan's man, the Antichrist, and the false prophet who's with him, and all the kings of the earth who align themselves with Satan and with the Antichrist, they're going to be so filled up with pride. And haughtiness is because they're going to think that they're in charge and they're in control. And he says, that's all going to go away. That's all going to be bowed down. The Lord alone shall be exalted in the day when He returns. For the day of the Lord of hosts shall come upon everything proud and lofty, upon everything lifted up, and it shall be brought low. Go down to verse 17. The loftiness of man shall be bowed down. The haughtiness of men shall be brought low. The Lord alone will be exalted in that day. But the idols, all the idols, including that image of the beast, will be utterly abolished. He says, then they shall go into the holes of the rocks and into the caves of the earth from the terror of the Lord and the glory of His majesty when He arises to shake the earth mightily. That's what's going to happen in those last days. Now, I'll be real honest with you. I have difficulty understanding the chronology of all the judgments that are described in the book of the Revelation. And I think that's understandable. It's a difficult book to put it all together. The sixth seal, again, seems to carry us up to the end, or at least almost to the end, when the Lord Jesus Christ is going to come again. So there's a couple different ways maybe of looking at this. The sixth seal seem to give us a panoramic view of the entire period of that Daniel 77. The beginning of sorrows in the first half, the martyrdom, and then what's going to take place right before Jesus Christ comes back. So that gives us a panoramic view of things. And then from Revelation chapter 7 through 19, goes back and fills in details. Some believe that that's the way to look at it. Some believe that the six seals carry us up to the final event that will precede the second coming of Christ, but that the seven trumpet judgments and the seven vial or bowl judgments are going to be poured out on the earth in a relatively short time frame toward the very end. And that's a possibility as well. Maybe we'll explore both of those as we look a little bit closer at it, but I'm not real sure. But notice the last thing that is said there in Revelation chapter 6. He says, the great day of His wrath has come, and who is able to stand? Well, I know in chapter 7, or Revelation 7, he's going to go back and answer that, and we're going to see the 144,000 are sealed. What we're going to do next time, the Lord willing, is we're going to go back to the seals, the six seals, and look at them a little bit more detail. I kind of brushed over them very quickly, and I want to spend a little bit of time looking at them in more detail. And so we'll talk next time about the four horsemen of the apocalypse. That's those first four seals, and that's what they're oftentimes referred to. The word apocalypse is the Greek word that means, that's translated revelation. So this is the revelation of Jesus Christ. We'll look at those four horsemen and look at a little more detail about what their coming will mean on the earth.